an Asian girl, I think she should have coffee-coloured almond-shaped eyes and hair that flows like black silk down her back.
Welcome to the Stella Podcast, a podcast celebrating Australian women's writing and hosting conversations about gender and literature.
Thank you for having us. I wanted to thank Northcote High as well. They've been a really long supporter of the Stella Schools program. I'm Bec Kavanagh and I'm the manager of the Stella Schools program. So we're very thankful that they've hosted this first provocation panel. I'll just quickly give you a bit of a briefing about what provocations are, and they're basically a series of online and in real life conversations about a range of issues that are being explored by contemporary female authors. So each provocation begins with a launch panel such as this one, which is recorded and podcasted on the Stella Podcast, and then followed up with a series of three blog posts, and then wrapped up with some recommended and further reading. So it's really designed to start conversations and encourage deeper thinking about a range of issues. So first I'll introduce our speakers and then we'll get straight into it. Our first speaker is Alice Pung, who is the author of Unpolished Gem and also more recently Lorinda. Leanne Hall, who her most recent book is Iris and the Tiger, and she won the text prize for her first novel, This Is Shyness. And Bec Lim, who is the author of a huge amount of books, including Afterlight and Mercy. And I'm very excited to have them, and I should actually thank Bec as well, because it was a conversation that she and I had that really inspired this panel in particular. And so she was actually one of the kind of initiators of the whole idea of provocations and having these conversations. So thanks, Bec. Where do I want to start? I want you each to tell me a bit about your personal background, because one of the reasons why we're here is that there is a lot of stereotyping, you know, around a lot of things, and in particular around what it means to be Asian in Australia, and that's one of the things we're going to explore tonight. But before we get to your personal stories, what I want to ask is, when you were growing up, what were the stereotypes that you were faced with in media and in literature about what it was to be Asian? So just if we can kind of step back from yourselves for a second and instead think about what it was that you saw and what that told you about what being Asian in Australia was when you were growing up.
I'm the oldest, so I'll probably start first. In the 1970s, I mean, essentially we were kind of invisible. So every Sunday we'd go out for yum cha and we'd walk around Chinatown. But when you watched TV and you listened to the radio, there was just... We just weren't there. And so all the Sri Lankans I saw, the Malaysians, the Indians, the Chinese people, they just weren't visible in the media. And that sort of went for my reading as well. A lot of my reading I sort of had to extrapolate from, you know, Judy Blume, Enid Blyton, books like that. We just weren't there. So you kind of take the common humanity out of the stories, but you don't actually see yourself. So that was my experience.
I would agree as well that pretty much anyone that looked like my family wasn't represented at all. I know that Bec has like terrible flashbacks about Neighbours episodes that happened in the 80s where they finally let there be an Asian family in Neighbours, and terrible storylines.
Actually, that was 1993.
Oh, so yeah. Terrible storylines ensued from that. I would say it was just a complete lack of representation, and I kind of looked for crumbs of feeling different and being different by seeing what there was from other cultures. So I was actually really, really interested in reading Jewish writers and reading about the Jewish experience, and really interested in reading about African-American race politics from a really young age, because at least there were those stories out there. But as for Asian Australian stories, there were none.
So when I was growing up, I went to a primary school where me and my brother were the first two Asian kids. But over the course of about 4 years, many of the class turned out, you know, went from being quite white to very Asian because of the boat refugees from Southeast Asia. And there was this ongoing joke, you know, people would say, how do you know if a Southeast Asian, a Vietnamese, Cambodian, a Chinese has robbed your house? And the answer was, your homework's done and your dog's gone. And so we laughed at that as kids because we thought it was pretty funny. But the stories that were coming out because it was an era of multiculturalism, were quite inspirational stories about boat people who came here on leaky boats and then succeeded at the end. So even though there were quite a few boat people stories, they weren't really stories about people I knew, even though all the people I knew at school who were Asian were boat people, they couldn't identify with them because they wanted to discard their FOBBY image. FOB stood for fresh off the boat, and they really wanted to be Australians. So whenever one of those stories like Alan Bale's little brother was assigned on the school curriculum, we would all cringe, you know, the Asian kids, because we were seen as poor boat people. But as an adult, I thought, oh, that's a wonderful thing that they did that.
So you kind of alluded to this, you know, in terms of that joke. I think obviously there wasn't, you know, any media or like cultural content, and especially literature, where you felt that you were seeing representations at all of your stories, let alone good ones. But what do you think other people were seeing? Like, what kind of stereotypes do you think were coming out in terms of if you'd said to somebody, I'm Asian, what do you think their understanding was? What kind of reactions were there?
I think Alice alluded to it, you know, with saying that the homework could be done. Even though there were no representations, obviously people were getting their stereotyped ideas from somewhere. And so, you know, there is the stereotype of the very studious Asian person, good at maths, good at science, doesn't cause trouble. I think if you're an Asian woman, it brings with it a whole other raft of stereotypes that very much relate to your gender as well as your ethnicity. And I often think that at school, I very much wanted to erase my cultural identity, like Alice was talking about, is you just wanted to make yourself Australian as possible, despite your appearance. And I feel like I often defined myself as a young person in opposition to the stereotypes. So I really focused on being really, really sporty and athletic because we weren't supposed to be good at sport. And I think as I got older and became a teenager, when all those stereotypes of a submissive Asian girl were put on me, I actually became, like, tried to be kind of really aggressive and in your face, even though anyone that knows me knows that I'm really not like that at all.
Unfortunately, I can't add much there because I actually was the submissive, not very good at sport, really bad eyesight, you know, Chinese person. So, and in my primary school, I was probably one of three. So there just weren't any people there to give a different representation. We were all very meek and we were all very good and we didn't play sport. We couldn't catch anything. I think I served a tennis ball into my own head. So it was proven pretty early that, you know, I kind of fit the stereotype. So unfortunately, yeah, that's my experience.
Well, that's actually probably a good segue into us talking about, you know, your individual backgrounds because, you know, one of the things that brings us here is that beautiful TED Talk by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, which is The Danger of a Single Story. And if you haven't seen it, then I highly recommend that you do. And, you know, I guess it's that idea of when there's one kind of representation of what it means to be a part of a particular group, in this case to be Asian. So it's, you know, people have this one idea of what it means to be Asian, and as soon as they fit somebody who has any of those traits, then it suddenly ticks off all these boxes. So one of the reasons that Beck was starting the conversation about this panel is that we were saying, you know, often when we think about diversity, in particular in relation to festival panels, is we often see like one diverse speaker on a panel. Which is obviously really important, but what it does is that speaker then becomes representative of a whole culture or a whole group of people, and in fact we miss out on the fact that, you know, there can be hundreds of different ways to live within a particular skin, to live in a particular identity, and so we wanted to explore that by getting, you know, three Asian female writers up on a panel together and to actually go, you know, these experiences are shared but also markedly different, and so it's just not good enough to have, you know, one voice being heard. So perhaps let's use this opportunity now to go through and give the brief personal backgrounds that we all talked about in email.
I mean, one of the, just going back to us having this initial conversation, Alice's family probably has more of the, I guess, as long as, I hope this is the right way to put it, like a refugee migrant experience.
Yeah.
And where my family is probably more of an economic migrant experience, and your family's been here for over 100 years. So they're completely different Asian experiences in Australia, but often, unfortunately, because I guess there's a lack of diversity in publishing, when someone says, get an Asian writer quick, they'll just sort of interchangeably, well, Leanne can't do it, so we'll get Alice. If Alice can't do it, we'll get Rebecca.
It's why we've never been on a panel, all three of us together.
We thought we would explode, like antimatter.
The universe is going to implode if you have three Asians on a panel at the one time.
So this is quite this is quite a big thing for us to be in the same room together. So, yeah.
We're not the same person.
We better not touch each other. Three people. do you want to go first, or do you?
Oh, you go.
So for us, my dad was a scholarship kid, so he came to Adelaide Uni in 1963. So he really was one of three Chinese people in his year level, and that was a big culture shock. He doesn't really talk about that time much, but, occasionally he'll drop these little pearls like, oh, yeah, I worked for Australia Post once. And if you've seen my dad, who's the most proper Chinese man, you can't imagine him carrying, bags of mail around. It's just amazing. But he doesn't really talk about that time because I think it was quite difficult. He went back to Singapore, and then he did his national service, and then he loved the life in Australia so much that he actually immigrated back. And he took my mother, who was a bit of a glamorous socialite, out of post-colonial Singapore, where she hung out with, cool Americans and had a beehive hairdo and fantastic gowns, and he put her in Warwick, Queensland, where he sort of became a base hospital doctor. So I think she cried for about, 6 months straight. And we did the classic living by the train line, really, really poor, trying to establish ourselves. And it was kind of like a cold chisel song, but with an Asian family in the middle of it. So that's our story. So I came when I was a toddler. They did the classic, the husband comes out first, tries to make a life, brings out the wife, then brings out, the children, that kind of thing. So that's our story.
I'll go next.
Yeah.
My background is that I'm Chinese Australian. So my dad's Anglo-Australian and my mum is Chinese Australian. The interesting thing is probably both sides of the family came out to Australia at roughly the same time, around about mid-19th century to late 19th century. On my dad's side, I think his family's like English and Welsh, and I think there's a bit of the English is kind of Cornish, which I quite enjoy thinking about because I've always been drawn to the old Cornish myths and Alan Garner and books set in Cornwall. And my mum's side of the family, both of her parents are from near Toisan, and my maternal grandmother's family came out, around about any time between 1850 and the end of the 19th century. We're not exactly sure because my family's not very good at writing things down and keeping family history. And my maternal grandfather came out around about 1920 when he was around 10 years old. And I can't for the life of me actually figure out how he emigrated to Australia at that time because the White Australia policy was in full force, so I think I need to do some family research about how we actually managed to get out here.
So my family arrived here in 1980. My mum was 8 months pregnant with me, and she said that, she says, don't think too badly on people smugglers, because she smuggled me into Australia at the Thai refugee camp. I think the nurses, because there's no ultrasound in a refugee camp, of course, you got hundreds and thousands of refugees and a handful of doctors and nurses, they, checked that she didn't have tuberculosis, that she wasn't going to carry diseases into Australia. And then they asked her how far along she was, and she just held up one hand, which meant she was only, at the most 5 months pregnant. So that's how they let her on the plane. So my family weren't boat people. They came here on a plane, and they came from the Cambodian genocide. So most of my family were wiped out from that genocide. My dad had two jobs. He, because Cambodia only has two seasons, wet and dry season. So during the dry season, he would make fertilizer with human poo and human remains, which is the people who died. And during the wet season, he would bury the dead. So he did that for 4 years. So when he came to Australia with my mum, he named me Alice because he thought this country was a wonderland, and he's never said anything bad about the country since. He, in fact, is one of those people that if Pauline Hanson wasn't so racist, she would love, because he's such a patriot. He reads Andrew Bolt. He doesn't believe the media can lie because he arrived in a democracy. So it's very interesting growing up with parents who aren't as literate as, So my mum only has a grade 2 education. They closed down the Chinese schools when she was quite young, and my dad, you know, finished school at 15. So they read certain newspapers that you would think were questionable. Yeah.
There's one other thing that I also want to recognise while we're on this topic of, you know, single stories and what it means for you all to be Asian in Australia, which is that reality of what Australia recognises as Asian. And it's something that's come up in the course of conversations that have been had about this panel. You know, in a lot of ways that's intentional because, as we said earlier, you know, we're trying to kind of break down that, oh, you're all from the same place, you know, you've got the same story. But I think it is indicative of a much bigger issue, and it's something that you mentioned, I think, in one of your emails, Beck, about, you know, the fact that even within China, there was how many subcultures did you say?
65 or 66 ethnicities, and you know the languages are completely different. And the part of China that Leanne's family comes from, Toisan, is the kind of tradition that I've married into. Mm. And after 24 years, I still can't quite speak the language properly. It's that different from Mandarin. Yeah. So, so when we see sort of like, I guess there's a danger where, for example, you know, there's a Benjamin Law story, but there's no other Asian stories behind it, and that's one thing that's missing from our media, I guess, a recognition that everyone's quite different.
Yeah, and of how
there are nuances.
Big Asia is as well, and how many, you know, different parts of Asia there are. We're actually going to be looking at this broad issue in a separate panel and podcast later in the year, but so we'll steer away from it a little bit for now. But I just wanted to recognise that because it did come up in your emails and in other conversations. Can we talk a bit about the impact of being an Asian woman and the impact that's had on the way that you move through the world? I ask because one of the recurring themes in our blog post as well is quite specifically about, you know, what it is to be an Asian woman. It's something that you sort of mentioned earlier, Leanne. And in fact, I was talking to a woman the other night and she was saying, you know, when we're women, our bodies are the first thing that are presented to the world. They're the first thing people see, and in fact, a lot of judgment comes about that. And so then I think, you know, to be an Asian woman, you've got kind of double expectations of who you are before you even open your mouth. So I just wondered if you could each maybe speak a bit to, you know, stereotypes that you've worked against or that you've found yourself falling into, or, you know, when did you realise that you were being stereotyped? It's something we're really interested in for Stella Schools, about that, you know, unconsciously allowing yourself to be kind of defined in particular ways, and at what point do you think about that and go, I'm not that anymore? It's big.
I think a large part of your identity is defined for you purely by other people. Mm-hmm. We think we control our identities, but often we don't. So, you know, once I gave a talk at a prison school, and you know, all the volunteers who wanted to be my talk were all settled, and then some kid at the outside yelled out, "Oi, you, do you eat dogs?" And then I felt like I'd lost that audience because they were snickering. So I was no longer the visiting author, I was the woman who ate dogs.
Yeah.
But in terms of my work, because I work as a lawyer and a legal advisor, when I first started out at 23, I always got mistaken for being the legal secretary. I was never, you know, sometimes people would just sit there and wait, and I wonder what they were waiting for, but they were waiting for the lawyer to emerge and take them into the meeting room. And I don't think, like, I never blame those people for being racist or anything like that. It's just we have perceptions of female lawyers that you see on television shows like Ally McBeal, or of femininity that's meant to be quite fierce. And
I actually think we've all got legal backgrounds.
Yeah, which is kind of scary.
And
that's another scary thing, because, I mean, that's another conversation to have. You know, the diverse people who've made it through the publishing gates all seem to have law degrees, which means we can speak English good. So,
Actually, writing is a really middle-class pursuit. It's a terrible career decision, and it's a terrible financial decision to make in your life. And you only make it if you have the confidence that you have some sort of familial safety net underneath you. Yeah. If you're truly in struggle town, you don't have the luxury of deciding to become a writer, or at least it's a lot more of a difficult decision to make. I found that my anglicised name and my youth and my ethnicity, I felt that when I was in a job where I had to negotiate contracts, actually worked to my advantage because people regularly underestimated me. And when I had meetings and they were expecting to meet with an Anglo-Australian and then I showed up, they would be so thrown that their bargaining power would be like reduced and they didn't negotiate as effectively with me. So I think sometimes it's worked for me. I think this is a big topic that I feel really strongly about, so it's hard to make one single comment about it. I would say that the feeling of being an Asian woman in Australia has been one of being very offensively exoticised and sexualised in a way that has not been on my terms at all and that I've really struggled with. And I feel like I have been too afraid to have that come out in my writing. And I write predominantly for young people, children and young adults. And I think, you know, the time of being a young adult is a really natural time to talk about emerging sexuality and that sort of thing. And it's only just in the book that I'm working on at the moment, it's only just coming out in my writing now. I've been very afraid to talk about it until now, but I think it's, like, important to.
Can I just ask, where do you think that fear comes from? And Alison Becht, is that something that you feel as well?
For me personally, I think it's that feeling that the real story I have to tell, the true stories that I have to tell, are not wanted and not acceptable in the publishing industry.
Okay.
Because they might sound angry and
They might sound angry and too full on. And also it's you expose yourself as a writer, so you have to be ready to tell a certain sort of story. And maybe I just haven't been ready to tell that kind of story and have that feeling of being exposed, kind of a personal side, exposed for discussion to a reading public.
Mm-hmm. I mean, my anger about the stereotyping has come out sort of the other way. Like, I've been quite afraid. I've written quite a few books for different age groups and I barely deal with being Asian. Mm-hmm. Like, when I was younger, because there weren't books about Asian people, I would read fantasy. So I call myself a fantasy writer. Like, yeah. I don't want to be limited by a migrant story. Because a lot of times people see a Chinese name and they'll say, write me a Wild Swans or write me, you know. And, that you know, those people have done it really, really well. They've done all the research. But I don't just want to be limited to that kind of story. I want to be able to write whatever I want to write and cross genres like everybody else. And, I mean, that's the frustration, that we seem to be told we have one story to tell people, whereas, you know, other writers from other backgrounds are allowed to write crime, they can write romance, they can do whatever they like. But for us, you're moving outside some kind of, you know, preconceived box if you decide to do something else other than a migrant story or an Asian story.
Yeah, look, I'm really interested in that, how you find a balance with that line, because, you know, I've heard a lot of people talk on these issues and I know that, you know, there are a lot of writers and a lot of other people and other people who have spoken publicly about it who think that there's almost an obligation, you know, that if you have the opportunity to write, that you should be using that opportunity to tell diverse stories and to tell, you know, to present characters that look like you for all of those teens that were like you that didn't have those characters. But then, you know, by that same token, as you say, you don't necessarily always want to be writing memoir, for example. I mean, Alice, this is probably a good one for you to start with, since you crossed over from writing memoir to writing fiction. You know, how did you struggle with that? Do you have people reading Lorinda and assuming that it's you?
Yeah, all the time, but I don't mind that. Yeah. And I don't mind. So I'm probably, of the panel, the writer that does the most Asian Australianness in my stories. Every single one of my books has an Asian Australian character that, you know, either has come here as a refugee or lives in an Asian. So my books are very Asian Australian books, and I'm just interested in telling those stories. I don't do it as a, you know, a way to sell more books. I never start off thematically thinking, oh, this is going to sell because it's an Asian Australian book. In fact, it's the opposite, because you think this is a niche book. People are going to look at my name. They associate me with certain things. So, yeah.
Do you think, though, like, this is something that you and I have talked about before, in particularly in relation to Lorinda, do you think, though, that sometimes that overshadows the other elements of your books that you would like to come out? I mean, it's when I say we've talked about it in relation to Lorinda, one of the key themes of Lorinda is actually a girl going to a new school and being very out of her depth class-wise. But I think often it's read as being very out of her depth because, you know, she's the only Asian student or, like, you know, one of the minority of Asian students at the school.
Oh, that's interesting, Beck. It's only been read as a race book by people who aren't Asian. People who are Asian. Yeah. You know, I had an American reader write to me and say, wow, I didn't know there were such things as poor Asians. You've really opened my eyes. And this was an Asian girl in her teens. So for me, that book explores class more than it explores race.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I've said to Alice before, the reason I relate to Lorinda so strongly is not for any cultural reasons, but more the class reasons, because I was in that position of being the scholarship girl at a private school. So it's a really strong part of the novel, I think, that's very relatable.
Yeah. Do you want to, we might sort of just pull back a bit to the earlier question. So to talk about, you know, that decision of how to identify your characters and how to present them to the world, and whether there's a sense of obligation or you know, defiance, or how you manage all of those expectations that whether or not they should be there, you know, are there based on who you are as an author.
For me, it's not really about the ethnicity of the character, although in one of my most recent books I did make her Eurasian to sort of discuss that disjuncture between the way she looks and the way she feels. But for me, it's really important because for a lot of my childhood I felt like an outsider. I usually try and make my characters, I guess in a lot of YA fiction, things like whether people have enough to eat, you know, whether they've got clothes to wear, that sort of is taken as a given. So for me, like, I try and make the character someone who isn't necessarily, I guess, a mainstream person who feels that outsider feeling, whether it's the way they look or they've got no money or where they live or they're practically homeless or they're, you know, they're missing a parent or something like that. So for me, I try and put the diversity in the sense that it's not necessarily about their skin colour, but it's about where they are in position to everybody else in their cohort.
For me, for my latest book, Iris and the Tiger, the character Iris Chen Taylor actually started life as being Iris Taylor, and she very much looked like Anne Shirley from the Anne of Green Gables books. Had red hair and beautiful pale skin, and she was like that for about six drafts, but I couldn't get to know her very well. I didn't feel that her character had much depth. And it occurred to me that I wanted to give her the same background as mine, Chinese-Australian, as a method of getting close to her and finding out who she was as a girl. So it allowed me to get closer to, like, 12-year-old Leanne, and then I was able to create this 12-year-old character that had a lot more depth than I really knew and was telling me her secrets and kind of opening up to me in a way that she hadn't previously. So it was purely just, that was my decision, was just to get to know the character more. In my future writings, I think I will consciously, not because I feel an obligation to any community to make characters a certain cultural background, but just because these characters have ideas that I want to explore. So I think that my future characters in other books probably will have quite similar cultural backgrounds to me. There's also that thing, look, when you start out as a writer, you basically feel like a little beggar grubbing around on the ground going, please publish me, please publish me. And you feel like this pressure to write something as broad and universal and as relatable and as palatable as possible. And when I first started out, I just didn't think it would be palatable just to slam a Chinese Australian character in there front and centre. You know, I'm not very courageous to, like, say that's the way it was, but you just don't feel like you have the weight or the pulling power. You have no star power and no in the situation, so you kind of do maybe more what you think other people will want.
Yeah, it's that weird thing of feeling like you need to be nice, but I read an article by Candy Bowers, who is a slam poet and theatre maker. She works with Hot Brown Honey. And she wrote a great piece for SBS, which is about, like, racism in the theatre world. And she was talking about that exact thing, you know, that need to be nice, and how she really struggles with whether or not she should be nice to make sure that her career continues, or, you know, whether or not she can now in her 30s start defining herself in the way that she wants to be defining herself. And actually, you know, as you were saying before, Beck, like if things make you angry, being angry, like at what point do we draw the line between...
And just go full feral, yeah, just let it all out, right? I mean, early in my career, and it's completely true what Leanne said, I was told point blank, you need to make it more generic. You know, like in the beginning, it's like, make it as commercial as possible. You know, everyone sees themselves in the characters. By everyone, they mean the people who buy books and who are the mainstream, you know, audience of the gatekeepers, that kind of thing. So I like to say that the older and uglier I get, the more I'm just sort of just going to let it all hang out and just write whatever I want. So I think you'll probably see, like, Leanne more, you know, overtly ethnic characters, I guess, in my books. But, yeah, before, you just had to be, you know, very, very sneaky and subtle about the way you put diversity in there because people just couldn't handle it.
I'm really interested in that for two reasons, partly because I think that... one of the questions that we get a lot from teens in panels like this is about the writing process and how you do things. So this is partly a question that will speak to that, but also because I've got a friend who's an Indigenous writer, and apparently he got asked about one of his books, why the characters weren't Indigenous, and he was like, well, I always just thought they were, you know? And so, you know, in fact, it's... And so the question, I guess, is... even if you believe, like, even if there is that ambiguity that, you know, you have written these characters to be like you, how do you explicitly write that into the book so that, you know, readers are aware of it without it being this character is Asian? You know, how do you kind of naturally bring that out when it is sort of unnatural to
state
those
details?
Well,
even if you make them explicitly a brown character like Suzanne Collins did with The Hunger Games, when that little young 10-year-old actress was shown in the movie as a brown girl, so many people wrote, what is this? Why is she a black girl? You know, they were so angry. They said they miscast her when it specifically says that she was a little black girl. So I don't know. People are going to read what they want even if you put clues in. If they're clueless, they will not see those clues.
I mean, one of my you know, really big signifiers was, I'm going to set this in Chinatown. You know, they're going to be running through restaurants. So this is kind of Asian, everyone. But that was like my big coming out with an Asian
If you're going to write an Asian girl, I think she should have coffee-coloured almond-shaped eyes and hair that flows like black silk down her back. Maybe some little feet, dainty feet or something like that.
But that's not how you write Iris.
No. I guess, you know, people do it a lot with names because, you know, in Australian society, people can be quite assimilated or integrated or have very much the same lifestyle, but they have completely different names coming from different parts of the world. So I think a lot of writers signify with names. You know, you have to be awfully careful to how you refer to characteristics of how people look when you're writing, because you don't want to fall into that kind of grossness that can happen when you describe people physically. And sometimes it just comes through in little bits of like lifestyle or cultural information that comes through in the book. Sometimes you just have to say outright, you know, what somebody's background is.
I mean, excuse the language, but I often piss off my readers by actually dropping foreign languages in. So often, you know, this is a signifier. He's just suddenly broken into Spanish. So I'll do that quite often. Like, this character's going to just say something in Russian, or this character will. So that's one thing that I do. I don't talk about the almond-shaped eyes, and I hope I never, ever use that phrase in my own writing. But generally, like, I'll give some kind of clue, like the way they speak, or, you know, like maybe they've got broken English, but not really dreadful, you know.
And do people really get pissed off? Like, has anybody ever contacted you? And
Online people will say, why does Rebecca Lim always just break into other languages? You know, why she's got so many, you know, she's so diverse. Why does she try to be so diverse? But it's the way the world is. Like, I'm trying to represent the world because, you know, you stand next to someone on the tram and they actually do break into another language. So that's one way of doing it without doing the whole appearance thing, which is, like you say, really gross sometimes.
Have you ever had pressure from your publishers to cut that out if readers are complaining about it online?
They check with me multiple times as to whether or not I've translated something properly. They'll go, are you sure that's how they say it in Spanish? Are you sure this is what it means? Mm-hmm. So I think that's their way of saying maybe there's too much Spanish, but I generally
or
just
maybe
go,
they're good editors. That That's good fact-checking.
It's good fact-checking. But, yeah, like I'll tell them, you know, maybe three times, I've had a Madrid Spanish speaker say this is fine. It's fine now. So let's just leave that one aside and keep going. So
there's also, I think, sometimes that feeling that if you've given your character a different cultural background as their identity, then that's all their identity can be and that's enough.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, you know, you can't have an Asian character who's also queer or, you know, has any other kind of type of identity that they describe to. You know, there's that feeling of, like, it's either, like, an ethnic book or it's not, or it has to be about something else, or this has to be a queer book. It can't be about cultural identity. It's like people don't really come out like that. They come out with incredibly complicated identities, and sometimes I feel like there's not enough books out there, just as a reader, there's not enough books out there that feature really, really complex characters like the people that I know around me.
Yeah. You've both, well, all three of you, but in particular Beck and Leanne, have seemed to be a lot more outspoken, you know, as you get older, and also, you know, as you publish more books and I guess have a bit more confidence about being able to push back against what editors might be strongly suggesting or what audiences are saying. What would it have helped you to hear as young writers to be able to have that confidence earlier on?
I mean, for me, it was a real shock because you don't actually think about it until you hit university or school and you start reading critical theory and you just kind of go, oh yeah, women have been really suppressed. Oh yeah, Chinese people have been really suppressed too. Oh, you know, and you learn all this stuff, and then, you know, my natural inclination, I find public speaking actually very horrific. But I think, you know, that whole thing you were talking about where, you know, Asians are perceived as mild and quiet and they don't cause trouble. I think if you're starting to have a slight public platform and you're trying to fix something that you know is really wrong, and people have been talking about it for like 60 years and they still haven't fixed it, you kind of have to force yourself to get out there and actually say, you know, it took me until I was 30 to recognise that, you know, mainstream publishing doesn't actually accommodate everybody's voice. It doesn't sort of show the full spectrum of the Australian story. And to realise at that age that, you know, there are so many stories and only some stories are getting through. I mean, maybe I'm slow and it took me a long time, but it was quite horrifying.
And is that what made you start the Voices from the Intersection project?
Kind of. I just found it... Well, it's not really a really
big
project.
Do you want to explain
project,
a bit what, yeah, about what that is?
Voices from the Intersection came about last year because after about 12 months, I'd been talking to publishers and publishing industry experts about why there weren't enough diverse books out there. And they were kind of saying things like, it's a really good idea, we're really behind it, but we don't know where to market these books, we don't know where to put them on the shelf, we don't know there's an audience for them. And so it's really a voluntary thing, but we're just trying to come up with events like a pitching day where we get, you know, people of colour, Indigenous people, disabled writers to come in and actually sit down and meet publishers face to face and see that they're not terrifying and actually tell them their story, you know, in a personal kind of way rather than trying to get through the submission guidelines that are on the websites. So Voices from the Intersection is recognising, like Leanne was saying, that there's intersectional stories. You don't just have one story from a Chinese writer. You might have a Chinese writer who is deaf. Mm. And I think we're kind of missing all those nuances in the publishing industry. Not only do we not see the diversity, but we also don't see, you know, dig down further to someone might be deaf as well as blind. Someone might be, you know, LGBTI, but they also might, I don't know, be from the Indigenous community or some other community. So Voices is really to try and give a visible avenue of publication or mentorship to people who aren't even being recognised by the publishing industry.
And do you think it might be a step towards kind of moving past the class issue that you mentioned before, Leanne, about, you know, writing being accessible mainly to middle class
people with law degrees?
Yeah, that's
what, yeah, absolutely.
Because, or supportive families or...
You know, I think a lot of the time when you try and get something published in this industry, you look at that massive, you know, 16 terms and conditions you have to get through before you even hit submit on your one chapter. And I think a lot of people, particularly from maybe poorer demographic or, you know, they've come from a broken home, maybe they're not fluent in English, they may have this absolute spark of creativity, but they can't get through the wall of words to actually get their stories there. So... the Voices scheme is really just to get those people out of their, you know, environment of feeling terrified about getting their work published and actually getting them to meet people and see that they want to help and that they recognise there's a problem and they want to do something. So that's why it came about.
Yeah, great. I think I'll finish in just a sec because I do want to leave a couple of minutes at the end for questions. But I did want to just ask each of you before we finish, what does diversity really look like to you? Like, if, because I don't believe that any of you would say that we've reached it yet in the book industry, or probably in any industry, but we're talking about the book industry. So what does it look like to you? Like, what would you love to see?
So I'll speak it from the perspective of having edited two books with quite, you know, what you call diverse contributors. When I edited Growing Up Asian in Australia, I did come across the submissions that Beck talked about, the authors who whose grammar wasn't perfect, paragraphs in the wrong place, but had a really strong voice. So, you know, I worked with those authors to get their writing up to scratch. They would never have got their writing published, never would have won any award, never would have done anything if they had gone through the proper channels and submitted it online or anything like that. So it was all hard copy submissions. And working with young adults in their writing, I find exactly the same issues. Grammar's not perfect. If they're from a low socioeconomic background, they have a very different voice. It's not as descriptive as it is full of action. And you've just got to recognise that the difference in voices is what makes these anthologies really come to life. So a lot of support, not saying, oh, we'll publish diverse books, but having mentorships and exactly what Beck is doing, things like that really help.
I think for me, I've worked in a bookshop on and off for over 10 years, and I quite often work in the children's and YA section at bookshops. So for me, diversity would mean if a parent or a teenager or a kid came in and said, you know, this is what I'm into and it's very, very hyper-specific, that I would go, yep, I've got the book for you. I know exactly what you want to read and here it is. And equally, it would also mean I've worked at one of the branches of the bookshop in like the eastern suburbs of Melbourne with a predominantly Anglo-Australian clientele, and I was always that horrible bookshop assistant that would always recommend the books by international authors or Asian authors. I would regularly try to hand sell Americana and Crazy Rich Asians in Hawthorne. Let's just name the suburb while we're at it. In Hawthorne, and so many people would not take me up on my offer, and I'd be like, I'm not deliberately trying to be subversive here. These are good books and I've read them and they're my favourite books, and can't you just open up your mind a little bit and read a work that has been translated? Like, it's not going to kill you to open up your mind. So for me, that's what diversity would mean.
I think for me, diversity would mean a day when we don't need a voices from the intersection and everyone's stories are worth the same. So like you say, someone could walk into readings and go, I want an Inuit skateboarding story with a gay character, and you go, there it is, you know, because it would have been published.
I would like that book. Okay, great. Let's open up for questions because we are on a bit of a schedule, so I need to ask everybody, if you do want to ask a question, that it has to be a question and not a comment, please. We can probably take two or three questions, and then if anybody wants to buy books and get them signed, I'm sure that Beck and Leanne and Alice would be happy to do that, and we'll also draw the raffle in just a minute. Does anybody have any questions? Yes.
For Alice, in the book Clorinda, do you feel you identify more with Lucy or with Ben?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I think both. It's a lot based on my personal experience, so that's why people keep asking me about it. I did go to an all-girls Catholic school, which was very small in the suburb of Braybrook, which is a factory suburb, and then I went to a private school in a leafier suburb. And when I was in that Catholic school, it was quite diverse. My best friends were, you know, Italian, Greek, Lebanese, Vietnamese. And because we're all the same, we're quite loud girls. And then when I went to the private school, it was like I was a completely different person. I was really scared. I was scared of making mistakes. And also, I mean, I tried to be the same. I told jokes. People didn't get it. It's the people in Hawthorne that Leanne talks about. They don't expect an Asian girl to tell jokes, you know? And so you try enough times and people take you so seriously, you just stop, you know? You squash parts of your personality and decide it's not important anymore. So I just put my head down and just conform to that stereotype. And it got me through the rest of the high school years, but I lost a lot of that joy and spontaneity I had when you're allowed to just blurt out anything in my, you know, Catholic school. That's an excellent question.
Thank you. Do we have any more questions? Yes.
Hi, that was fantastic. Thank you. I've been doing a bit of research around diversity in publishing, and in particular there's lots of stuff that's come out about the American industry and the idea of gatekeepers, so literary agents and publishers all being quite white, because as you say, it's a class issue, it's a profession you can only have if you're middle class. Do you think that's the problem with the Australian industry, and then that's why they're always trying to pitch books by other writers, Asian writers, for example, as exotic? Or do you think that it's a more of a canonical issue that, you know...
It's kind of everything, isn't it?
Such a great question.
Yeah, it is a really good question.
Go ahead. For me, it was largely a commercial, from my experience, because I was first picked up by my publisher, who I've been with for over 15 years. Very, very small publisher. So they picked me up and they thought I'd be a niche writer. They only published, you know, they only printed a very small first run. So they took a risk because they were more a niche publisher. They were black ink. They dared to go out there. But I don't think a big commercial publisher would have accepted my work. And I tried very hard with big publishers. I just couldn't get through the door.
Yeah, it's a whole thing about... I mean, again, it boils down to, you know, what's commercial, and then the people who actually make it into the publishing industry. And they're all the kindest people, but they do kind of come from a particular background. And yeah. I mean, with the Voices pitching day that I'm doing next month, I've had bloggers in Sydney, for example, complain that, you know, what's the point of having this thing? All the publishers who are going are white anyway. Mm-hmm. But at least there's a will to actually recognise that and start taking on internships. So, for example, one of the publishers who's coming on the pitching day, Alan and Unwin, they've actually gone out to the, I think it's the copyright agency, and they said, give us some funding so we can put some diverse interns into our businesses. And then they've sort of, you know, called out to the rest of the publishers, we're doing this, what are you doing about it? So you've got to get the ball rolling somewhere, and you recognise that there's endemic problems. But I think now, like, we're at a point in time where it's been like 53 years or 60 years since, you know, American literary commentators have said everything is just the same. Like, when is it going to change? And I think, you know, it's kind of a tipping point now, which is good.
I think we could probably talk for a lot longer, but we have to wrap it up here. So I'm going to get everybody to join me in thanking Alice and Leanne and Beck.
Stella's theme music is by Geryon. That's Geryon. You can find a link to their work on our podcast homepage or in the description of the episode. The Stella Prize is on Twitter and Facebook, and you can find out more about the prize and other Stella activities, like Girls Write Up and the school's program, on our website, thestellaprize.com.au. The Stella podcast was made on Kulin Nation's land in Naarm, Melbourne. We pay respects to the traditional Wurundjeri owners of this land, the elders past and present, and to the sovereign Indigenous owners of the land wherever this podcast may reach.